This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We got trains today and the housing market. Also, a couple of virus stories because it is trying to take back this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday, today, the 4th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The macroeconomic lead on this program this afternoon is brought to us by the letters A, D, and P. The payroll data company, ADP, came out with its monthly jobs report this morning. Remember, we get the official government numbers on Friday. And there is often not a real strong correlation between the two, but data is data. So we went looking for some tidbits, courtesy of Elizabeth Crowfoot. She's a senior economist at the Conference Board.
Surprisingly, we've seen some weakness in the healthcare sector, for example. The retail sector, some areas are much stronger than others. And also construction has been relatively weak in the past several months.
Construction in July only added 1,000 jobs, ADP says. But more to the point,
it's really going to be a bumpy ride going forward in terms of labor market recovery. There's a lot of fear about getting infected with the virus. There are still childcare issues that are happening, especially for mothers.
Remember what Jay Powell said last week, right? It's not going to take that long to get back to a more normal labor market, he said, in macroeconomic time. Whatever that is. All right, moving on. You have heard the news about New York by now, I'm sure. After a transition period to get everybody used to the idea, starting September the 13th, you're going to have to be at least partially vaccinated to do a bunch of stuff inside in the city. Go to the gym, see a concert or a show, also eat indoors at a restaurant. Much as was the case when mask mandates became a thing, a lot of the enforcement is going to fall to businesses. And as you might imagine, they are feeling kind of mixed about the whole thing. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra did some asking around.
The Tin Cup Cafe, a breakfast and lunch spot in Brooklyn, has been around for about a decade, but it has barely survived the pandemic. Partner and general manager Craig Hanfield says last year the restaurant was making maybe a fifth of what it used to.
And just when we thought that we were, okay, wow, we could breathe easy and wipe our brow, wipe the sweat of our brow, wow, that was a close one. Now I'm concerned that, okay, here we go again.
Here we go again, COVID is surging. Also, here we go again, putting restrictions on customers. Hanfield is conflicted about the mandate. He wants more people to get vaccinated, but he thinks it'll be hard to enforce.
I mean, what do you do if somebody can't prove they're vaccinated? You've asked them not to come in? Like, who makes those decisions? Is it I have to police that?
The logistics are not clear. Like just a couple buildings over at a restaurant called J Diner, manager Giselle Tapia is standing behind the counter. She's the only one working. I ask her, when this mandate goes into effect, would she be the one checking vaccination cards?
I mean, probably. Or maybe, like, we may have somebody at the door who, like, waits for people and is just like, okay, and, like, sits them down.
Which would mean paying somebody else to guard the door all day. She's not sure what she'll do if a customer doesn't have proof. Also unclear, what the mandates will do to sales. Andrew Ridgey, executive director at the New York City Hospitality Alliance, says it could be a good thing.
If you have some people that have stopped going out or limiting eating out because they're uncomfortable with the Delta variant, and now this could bring them back.
On the other hand, he says people who aren't vaccinated might stop going out to eat. Ridgie says he hopes the mandate has its intended effect and pushes more people to get vaccinated, because a lot of restaurants can't handle another round of closures and capacity restrictions. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was two down, one up on the major indices. We will have the details when we do the numbers. To mandate or not to mandate? That is the vaccine question for a whole lot of companies. The rideshare giants Uber and Lyft have made the increasingly popular split decision. Employees who want to go back to the office got to get their shots. Drivers obviously don't have to go back to the office proper. But what to do about them reveals the question behind the question for a lot of companies. What they've got to gain and what they've got to lose. Marketplace's Matt Levin reports.
Uber and Lyft have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on ballot measures and lobbying to keep drivers classified as independent contractors. So, basic legal question first. Can a gig economy company force a gig economy worker to get the vaccine?
Of course they can.
Vinu Dubal is a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. She says rideshare companies already mandate a bunch of things.
The car has to be maintained in a certain way. You know, the drivers have to wear masks.
Both Lyft and Uber said they strongly encourage drivers to get vaccinated. Stanford Business School professor Paul Oyer says anything stronger could backfire just when ridership was approaching pre-pandemic levels.
There are going to be a bunch of drivers out there who are vaccine resistant, who will therefore not be able to drive for them. And given that right now they're having trouble getting enough drivers, that's a big issue.
On the other hand, Oyer says a mandate that includes drivers and riders could boost business in some places where passengers are looking for reassurance. Karen Reinke drives for Uber and Lyft in San Antonio. She's vaccinated. She's also 56 and diabetic. So when someone sneezes in the back seat,
you know, I immediately get out of the car and I wipe everything out.
Ryan Key thinks a driver mandate would be great.
So I think that drivers would be okay with it. If they're not okay with it, all the more money for me. They don't have to drive.
She says at the very least, the app should let riders know she's vaccinated. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
How about her? She was great, huh? Look, if you miss us on the air, we've got an answer for that. You can check out our podcast, the platform of your choice, or marketplace.org. It's there as well. Check it out. Ticker symbol BRK off 1.1% today, closed at a nice round $420,000 a share. That is not a typo. BRK, of course, is Berkshire Hathaway, the A shares, Warren Buffett's holding company for, among other things, Benjamin Moore, the paint people, Duracell, Fruit of the Loom, and also the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, which I love because the idea of Warren Buffett investing in trains is just great, but also because it lets me make this turn. Buffett was once asked which economic indicator he would choose if he was stranded on a desert island with access to only one such indicator. And of all the possibilities, consumer confidence, inflation, unemployment, factory output, there are a zillion of them. Buffett chose freight rail traffic. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is on the train desk today.
About 10 years ago, when my kids were little, we'd head to the train tracks a few blocks away and stare at the freight trains lumbering by. My kids grew out of their train fixation. I did not. I find myself at the tracks again, eyes glued to a passing CSX freight train loaded down with what looked like coal. The Association of American Railroads sends out weekly updates on rail traffic. It's a trade group for the freight lines. Ian Jeffries is the CEO.
what we move is the economy. It's the tangible economy. And so as the economy goes, rail goes. So when rail's doing well, that usually means the economy's running pretty strong.
Jeffrey says right now, rail is doing really well, especially what they call intermodal train traffic, when products travel in containers from ships to truck or train.
For the first half of 2021, so January through June, intermodal originations or intermodal traffic is the highest volumes we've ever seen.
Jeffrey says intermodal train traffic was up more than 17% from the first half of last year. No surprise there, because train shipments fell off during the pandemic, like the rest of the economy. But intermodal train traffic was also more than 5% higher than 2019, which was a good year. These intermodal trains are brimming with the imported products consumers are demanding.
And this is a good sign.
Diana Furchgott-Roth is a former deputy at the Transportation Department, now teaching at George Washington University.
It's a good sign, first of all, that people have money to spend. And second, it's good that they have confidence to spend.
So the freight rail tea leaves are pointing squarely toward more economic growth, right? Actually, Furchgott-Roth says this year it's complicated. U.S. ports are backed up with a traffic jam of ships full of imports. And because of that whole intermodal thing, problems at the ports can cause problems on the rails. And shipments for the holidays are starting now. Furchgott-Roth says it could take longer for imported products to reach store shelves.
If we don't have enough goods shipped by rail, if the congestion continues, the prices will be higher.
Freight rail also tells us about U.S. exports. And right now, rail shipments of grain are down. Joseph Schofer says that's kind of weird since farmers are producing plenty. Schofer teaches civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. He says grain might also be caught up in the international shipping snag, or maybe it's a storage issue.
If you don't have enough storage, you can't move product and the system slows down or freezes up.
Schofer says rail shipments of other raw materials like ores, metals, and chemicals are up. He says they're going to U.S. factories, which are ordering a lot of supplies right now.
Because they have either expectations that they can sell more products or they have firm orders for more products.
Schofer says either way, it's a vote of confidence in the economy, pointing the way to more economic growth this fall. How much growth depends on, of course, COVID, but also how long it takes to unclog the ports and sort out storage issues and other bottlenecks that could cut into the rail shipments the economy needs to keep humming. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's not an enjoyable market. It's a challenge.
Well, that's not good. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 323 points today. 0.9% finished at 34,792. The NASDAQ picked up 19, about a 0.1%, 14,780. The S&P 500 dropped 20 points, 0.4%, 44.2 there. A little follow-up on Mariel's piece about New York City. The New York Fed gave us a reminder just yesterday of how important the Big Apple's economy is to the nation's economy. The five boroughs, can you name them, by the way? Anyway, generated just shy of 5% of this country's GDP in 2019. A little over $1 trillion, New York City's GDP is. It would put it in the top 20 in the world, ahead of Switzerland, also the Netherlands. Good times at the New York Times. The news outlet beat analyst. News outlet, I love that. Beat analyst revenue and earnings expectations. Shares closed up 7.6%. They've got like a bajillion digital subscribers. That was the big news. Bonds down. Yield on the 10-year T-note up just a touch, 1.18%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is, I don't know, I guess you'd call it infrastructure summer, right? Because it is going to be a good long while before that hard infrastructure package, the $1 trillion one, gets through Congress, let alone the $3.5 trillion bundle of human infrastructure support. But in that first bill is an explicit recognition that the climate crisis is an infrastructure problem. And that gets us to this. A new study from the Government Accountability Office that says more than a quarter of homeowners who bought policies through the National Flood Insurance Program dropped that coverage within 5 years. So imagine it's your job to get more at-risk homeowners to sign up for those policies. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
28% of people who had flood insurance in 2014, for whatever reason, didn't in 2019.
That number doesn't even tell you how bad it is.
That's former FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate. He says that number only applies to folks who received assistance when their houses flooded or with federally backed mortgages who live in 100-year floodplains. They have to have insurance.
The bigger number is the people who don't live in a special flood risk area that don't have flood insurance, that are at flood risk and have no coverage.
Like many of the folks in the Houston area during Hurricane Harvey. For a lot of those affected, that storm was a rain event. They weren't told they had to buy flood insurance, so they didn't.
It's not an unknown problem. It's a marketing and communication problem.
But it's also a data problem. Alicia Puente-Cackley is with the Government Accountability Office.
Everybody has pieces and nobody has all of it.
For instance, bank regulators monitor the mandate for flood insurance while FEMA actually administers the coverage. And Carolyn Kuski, executive director of the Wharton Risk Center at the University of Pennsylvania, says there are holes in the data, too.
There's no way to know why someone dropped their policy.
Maybe they moved. Maybe they sold their house. Maybe they couldn't afford it anymore.
So it makes it hard to know, you know, how much is really a compliance problem and how much is not.
The upshot is, it's really tough for homeowners to know if they're at risk of flooding and should get insurance. The GAO report suggests FEMA take the lead. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You remember the power grid problems that Texas had back this winter? Those ice storms and then the blackouts and the huge electricity price spikes? A lot of that happened, not the storm, of course, but the after effects, because Texas has a largely deregulated power grid. Without being I-told-you-so-ish, Texas could have learned a thing or two from California, which 20 years ago had its own deregulated power market and rolling blackouts and seemingly unexplained price spikes. But we had them, thanks in part to a Texas-based company that has, or had, I suppose you'd say, its own not-so-great history. From KQED, Lily Jamali has that story.
Steve Weissman was on a camping trip in Central California when he learned that the president of the state's Public Utilities Commission was urgently trying to reach him.
So I drove to Groveland, California, got on the payphone on the main street, and we had a conversation. They were seeing dramatic blips in the price for electricity that was being paid in the wholesale market.
Weissman had left his job at the Utilities Commission a year earlier. After that call, he promptly returned to head up its initial probe into California's skyrocketing power prices in 2000. He was certain it stemmed from the recent deregulation of California's power markets, a push influenced by the Houston-based energy giant Enron.
It obviously recognized it wanted to play a role in the California markets. So it inserted itself in all of the proceedings where the rules were being established. So they were, I think, largely successful in creating a set of rules that were designed to work to their advantage.
Enron was hardly the only company to take advantage, but it played a central role, crafting schemes to withhold power with nicknames like Death Star, Fat Boy, and Ricochet. That last one involved buying power from California at lower, capped prices, sending it out of state, then selling it back to California for a lot more when it was desperate. The ensuing blackouts made national news.
For the second day in a row, not enough electricity for America's largest state and the world's sixth largest economy.
It took a year before federal regulators finally stepped in, capping prices regionally, along with other measures. The crisis cost then-California Governor Gray Davis his job in a recall election.
I suspected all along that Enron was up to no good. I never thought they would be ordering blackouts, but that's exactly what they did.
Years later, audio tapes unearthed by a tiny public utility district in Snohomish, Washington, captured Enron employees boasting about gouging power customers throughout the West.
So the rumor is true? They're taking all the money back from you guys? All the money you guys stole from those poor grandmothers of California?
Yeah, Grandma Millie, man.
In addition to gaming California's power markets, Enron had been up to something else, misleading its investors. After the company went bankrupt, some top executives served time for securities and accounting fraud. Three energy traders were also convicted for manipulating California's markets. While Enron is gone, California's energy markets are still deregulated. Here's UC Berkeley economics professor Meredith Fowley.
I'm not going to suggest that the markets are perfect, but I think there's pretty clear evidence that restructuring has improved efficiency at power plants. It's improved coordinations of operations across the grid.
Fowley says one misstep in California's approach was limiting how much power the state could secure ahead of time, leaving much to the spot market. Former Governor Davis agrees.
About 25% of the power we need, we begin to look for at about 4 in the afternoon of the day we need it from the 11 western states.
Last summer, California suffered its first rolling blackouts in almost 20 years. It was a giant red flag to Loretta Lynch, who is California's top utility regulator under Davis. She placed that call to Steve Weissman when the energy crisis began in 2000. Lynch says deregulation is the problem.
And we created an electricity market that has become a casino for the electricity traders, and we all pay and pay and pay. We have to shut down that casino and protect our people and our businesses.
California faces more potential rolling blackouts this year due to a historic drought, but Lynch says the grid's greatest vulnerability remains market manipulation, even today with Enron long gone. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
It's not great out there for people looking to buy a house. Oh, so many people want them, but there just aren't enough of them on the market at prices would-be buyers can afford. A couple of months ago, we heard from a realtor in Missoula, Montana, for our series Adventures in Housing. Mindy Palmer is her name, and she was telling us back then about what a high-demand, low-supply housing market looks like from where she sits, and we figured right about now would be a good time to get her back on the air.
The real estate market in Missoula is not for the faint of heart. I'd say a day doesn't go by that I'm not commented by somebody saying, oh, you must love this market right now. You must be making money hand over fist. And I always stop them right there. And God help them, they get my elevator speech every time. And that is, no, it's not an enjoyable market. It's a challenge. There are 855 members in the Missoula County Organization of Realtors. Currently, there are 177 residential homes for sale. Doesn't take a math whiz to figure out that you've got some competition out there right along with your buyers. All you have to do is pull up to a listing that just hit the market. You're likely to see multiple cars parked along the curb. You see agents and their buyers huddling. You know, if the showings are scheduled for half-hour increments. By golly, they're going to take that full 30 minutes inside that house and not give you one inch. You will be waiting. You will be sizing each other up. And it's interesting. It's very interesting. I've established my business working with a lot of first-time home buyers, and they are getting edged out of the local scene. For example, this summer, worked with a couple that were in a rental. A lot of sellers are selling their rentals. A lot of renters are being displaced, and that's adding to the stress of the market. They were very pregnant, and they had a very short amount of time to try to find something. So we would hit the out-of-town markets on their days off, and that would mean driving round trip probably anywhere from 150 miles, 175 miles round trip, just to look at one or two properties that were available. And we finally, you know, about a couple weeks before they had to be out of their rental, we did find a place. And by then, the baby had just been born. So you're working twice as hard for the same amount of money. But when your client does get the house, when you do find that first-time home buyer something, it's the greatest feeling in the world. You bet that's a triumph. And to get hugged around the legs by a 7-year-old girl who says thank you, you know, that's going to keep me going for a few more transactions, let me tell you.
Mindy Palmer. She's with Berkshire Hathaway Montana Properties in Missoula, Montana. Oh, look, another Berkshire Hathaway company. Your adventures in housing are what make this series go, you know. So please, share them with us at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, another slice of the climate crisis story. Saw this on Gizmodo. The real estate company Redfin will now tell you how at risk your house is because the planet is getting hotter. Scores are from 0 on the good end to 100 on the don't buy it end. 5 main climate factors: storms, temperature, drought, fire, and floods over a 30-year time horizon, which is the mortgage most people get, obviously. I, by the way, I'm kind of afraid to look up my own house. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, Schadenfreude edition. Starting today, you could trade options on Robinhood stock, the gamified trading platform that got famous after the whole Reddit GameStop AMC thing. Anyway, in what goes around comes around, Robinhood shares were so volatile today, trading was stopped 5 times to let things calm down. Nevertheless, finished up 50% today, Robinhood shares did. Our media production team is Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squalace, Trollton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.